Hi, you're listening to the Cars and Crafts Radio Show here on KPPF Radio 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM. Every Sunday at 2 p.m., we have a great lineup for you today. Visit Montservino Urban Winery at 4655 Town Center Drive, Suite 130 near Platt and Murray, and spend time,
like we did,
with Matt and Katie in their cozy tasting room sampling beautifully made wines
and handcrafted Boxing Brothers hard cider.
Come find your favorite.
Join us on the air and online.
Cars and Crafts and KPPF remind you to drink responsibly.
And stop by and see Jim and his wife. They're there every day. And Remy, the poodle, at his shop, Reincarnation, Colorado Springs. The address?
6085 Terminal Avenue.
Every week, we'll chat with an ambitious achiever.
Or two.
In the local world of cars and handcrafted adult beverages. Here on Cars and Crafts with your hosts, Linda.
And David.
On KPPF, the power
of people.
To Cars and Crafts on 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM. You're sitting in the studios with myself, Linda, and David.
Good morning, Linda.
And Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Verhey.
Hi, Jim. Say hi, Verhey. Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Reincarnation. Perfect. And DJ in the background. Hi, DJ.
We had Jim here last week or 2 weeks ago, whenever it was. We talked about Formula One after the Sochi race. He had such a great perspective. He's such a great guy. We wanted to come back this week and talk about
F1 stuff.
The Turkey Trot. The race in Turkey. Jim, your thoughts?
Great race. I would never be disappointed when Valtteri wins.
Especially your comments last time where you were praising Valtteri, thought he was underrated, was kicked to the curb, unfortunately, by Mercedes. I supported you in that. I followed Valtteri's career coming up. I've been very impressed. So that was cool.
Well,
you called
and then
it. You called it.
There's nothing to call. It's common knowledge that he's been fired. But try and find somebody that's going to be happy coming in second every week. That's the problem, I think.
That is tough to do.
Well, it's always been a problem. We've talked about that before. We could do a whole show on drivers that were number two.
True.
The guy that had to sit next to Senna, the guy that had to sit next to Schumacher, Rubens Barrichello, famously.
Oh, yeah.
Very good driver, very competent. Yeah.
To let Michael pass at the last straight.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's team orders.
Oh, Mark Webber and Verstappen back at Red Bull. There's lots of these things that went on.
Mark Webber when he flew through the air.
Well, that was Le Mans.
Yeah, he's one of the few drivers that's flown twice in his car.
Yeah.
Once in Le Mans. I forget where the other one was.
I think they were all Le Mans. I don't know if it happened anywhere else, but I could be wrong.
He did it in an F1 car.
Oh, yeah.
He dug into a wall.
Wow.
I remember seeing it. I don't remember the details. We sat behind him at Cirque du Soleil in 2007 in Montreal when we went to the 2007 Canadian Grand Prix. And that was the holy boy, what's his name there, Hamilton. That was his first pole and his first win.
Wow.
We happened to be there, and I've got a signed poster from him at the shop.
That's cool.
Cool track, cool race. It had to be a great weekend for you guys.
Fun. Yeah, it was fun. And we went to Cirque du Soleil, and we happened to be seated behind Mark Webber, all the F1, Jackie Stewart.
Holy
remember
cow.
Remember the team boss for Renault? Very beautiful Italian name that got thrown out for life because he arranged the accident.
Yeah, Flavio Briatore.
Flavio Briatore,
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah,
that's
Flavio Briatore. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was...
they were all sitting in front of us. And then David Coulthard.
Yeah.
And his statuesque supermodel wife.
Yeah.
And Eileen said to me, she's not that pretty.
Nice.
Well, there was the confirmation I was looking for.
There you go.
Well, Coulthard also famously, a number two driver that never quite got his due. I remember when Webber retired, Webber's 6'2". 6'1".
He's very tall.
He's very tall for an F1 driver. When you said you sat behind him, I expected some comment about you couldn't see the show or something. But
and his wife's just as tall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he famously said when he retired, I finally get to eat because he's so tall. He had to keep his weight. I don't know.
Yeah.
He was probably around 160 pounds, maybe. I don't know his career, but all muscles, super lean.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Waiting 10 years to eat, that's stuff you don't think about when you think about
racing
car drivers.
Great personality.
Yeah.
You know who else I'm a big fan of? And he didn't win, but he placed this weekend was, the Spanish guy?
Alonso?
Thank you. Fernando Alonso.
Yeah.
Here's a guy you can put in any car in the world. Remember when he raced at Indy several years ago?
Yeah, yeah.
Out of the blue. He'd never been in an Indy car in his life. They put him in an Indy car at the Indy 500.
Never been on an oval in his life.
May as well start at the Indy 500. There's nothing bigger.
That's right.
And he was running first when the Honda engine, and this never happens, broke, 3 laps from the checkered flag.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
He was that close to winning the race. He'd never been in the car.
No, his
amazing
natural talent.
His Renault that he drove to his championship, and the team manager at the time was Flavio Briatore. That was that time period. But that car, other drivers have tried to drive that car since. That car is virtually undrivable. It was back in that time period with the V10, had the narrow chassis with the groove tires, if you remember. 18,000 RPM redline, something ridiculous.
Yep.
By the way, if you do the math on that, and I'm not going to do it right here, and I'm not going to pretend to be able to do it that quickly, but something like the piston is moving through the cylinder like 150 times a second or some stupid number. Yeah.
Per second.
Yeah, just ridiculous to hit that kind of red line. That car, not only was it nervous as a new filly to drive, but violently quick, but also it was such a downforce driven car that it wouldn't actually stop or turn a corner until you got to a certain speed. So until you're, unless you're Fernando and you can drive the car anywhere near the limit, it's virtually undrivable. This is what I'm getting from other pilots that have tried to drive that car.
Yeah. He's a very talented driver, always has been. And he's got to be an antique. I don't know his age, but he's got to be pushing 40.
Yeah, he's got to be pushing 40. Well, he was out for a couple of years and came back, but he's done a great job. So some highlights, I thought the rain was a big deal.
Yes.
At the it affected qualifying and also affected the race a little bit differently than it affected Sochi. My overall comment was, until the last 10 laps, I found the race kind of dull and I was trying to analyze.
I was kind of thinking the same thing. It was just a regular race. But I was thinking about you, Jim, at the very beginning, how you were talking about the guy talks so fast that you just kind of mute the thing.
Oh, God.
I was thinking about you the whole time. It was great.
But he kind of turned it down, didn't he? I don't remember him doing that screaming for the first two laps. Maybe I missed it. Maybe
I
zoned out.
So I missed it entirely.
Yeah.
But, and you know, the race, there's a case to be made for most F1 races. I'm sorry to say this, but it's true, are boring.
Yeah.
Because there's not a lot of passing. There's not a lot of crashing. I mean, why do people watch NASCAR? Blood. Blood sport. But why do they watch F1? It's a technical sport.
Well, and
finesse.
My brother and I used to have the comment that the whole excitement about F1 led up until qualifying. And after qualifying, it was all over because you got all the news from the previous race. You got all the changes to the car, all the strategies and that kind of stuff. And the race was actually a procession based on what happened in qualifying. Now, it's a little bit different these days because they've brought the cars closer together. They've kind of NASCAR'd it to a degree. But I was trying to figure out why I thought the Turkish race was a little dull. The other part of it is going into that race, Turkey holds the record for the number of overtakes in a single race. I think there was 59 59 overtakes, which is allegedly the record. So, you know, you would think that it'd be, you know, exciting, especially with Hamilton coming from 10 spots back, and Saints was at the back of the pack also, I think, or somebody.
Yeah, he was in the back seat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd think it'd be more exciting, but it just didn't happen. Now, the rain affected that, you know, harder to control the car. The track didn't dry at all because of the lower temperature, I guess, so the track just stayed wet, made that awkward. Then I was thinking about the other part of it is we didn't have Martin Brundle. We had Jenson Button at calling the color on the commentary. And Jenson, to his credit, he's laconic. He's relaxed. They used to talk about Jenson when he won the world championship for Russ Braun, the converted Honda team, that his driving style was so easy on the car, so easy on the tires, just so effortless. He's so smooth.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, which matches his personality.
Yes.
And then when he didn't win later on in a different car, they accused him of not hustling the car enough because he's so smooth and he's so cautious and he's so careful. But I think his commentary, not to pick on Jenson, but I think his commentary didn't help the race. His commentary was insightful. It was good, but he didn't.
Wasn't exciting, didn't push you off your seat, didn't create the emotion that typically comes.
Yeah,
the
he
race.
Wasn't criticizing drivers. He wasn't criticizing the teams. Later on in the race, he kind of did.
It's because they're all buddies.
Yeah. I mean, he's a smart guy.
There's nothing wrong with that, but it doesn't sell soap.
Yeah. But, you know, Martin Brundle, he doesn't care. You know, he was the king years ago, and he doesn't have any shoes to polish.
He was never a world champion or anything.
No.
No.
But a super quality guy and a super quality driver.
Yeah. Well, they did talk about, and I don't know if it was practice or qualifying, they were talking about how the cars were so much faster than the previous year. Did you pick up on that? Yeah. I didn't know what it was, why or whatever. I just thought it was kind of interesting that everybody was exceeding the previous records.
Yeah, by quite a bit. Natural improvement of the cars. The cars evolve all the time. Even if it's by tenths of a second, it adds up. But the other part of it was the surface had changed. Last year, they had just repaved the track. And I didn't remember that we raced in Turkey last year. I thought it had
really
been years
over
that. Yeah, it was really green.
Yeah.
And so you couldn't get any time out of it. Okay. So now it's a year older.
But it rained the night before, so it was still pretty green.
Yeah.
This year. But it had a year's worth of rubber worked in there somewhere.
Right. Yeah. And some of the natural oils that come to the surface had been washed away. I won't go into all asphalt construction.
And I'm sorry to say it, but it's nice to see Lewis. I'm not going to say
not
lose.
Not take pole.
But not win. Not take pole and not win.
Check his attitude.
Well, let's talk about the controversy see at the end. There's been news reports about it. The team told him to pit. He was running in third.
And he says, why?
He said, why?
Yeah, he was not happy.
The car's driving.
Not a happy camper.
Yeah. So he didn't pit. And then you're thinking he's going to run it all the way to the end and try to hold into third place. But they wound up pitting anyway. Jensen, the highlight of his entire broadcast, when they said, Lewis, you need to pit box, they say. Mm-hmm. Lewis said, okay. Jensen goes, he didn't get it. He didn't understand. You know, he doesn't understand what's going to happen, that he's going to drop back to fifth or sixth. 30 seconds later, that's exactly what came out from the Mercedes pit in Lewis's radio. That was fantastic by Jensen, I thought, to pick up on that.
Yeah, and he did blow that. Mm-hmm. I was surprised. It's intriguing a question to me because I'm not a Lewis fan. I'm sorry, I don't like a guy that always wins.
Yeah.
I was a Michael fan early on, but then I fell away.
I'm with you.
But why was Red Bull all dressed in white?
It was a Honda. They were honoring Honda. It was a Honda throwback livery.
Oh, okay.
I think it is an anniversary. And I think this week was supposed to be Suzuka, and then COVID changed all that around. So I think some of that went on. But it was it was an old Honda livery. Yeah.
Yeah. And there were a lot of Japanese people milling around there.
Right.
So that may well be. I didn't know. I like the blue.
But so I did like the blue.
They didn't ask me.
So later,
I couldn't believe it.
Later news reports have come out that Hamilton was wrong not to pit when Mercedes asked him to the first time. Martin Brundle actually wrote up an opinion piece that said that. And I mean, should Hamilton have pitted with three laps to go and dropped to sixth place?
No. Not in my opinion.
No.
He has the ability to make his own choices, right? I mean, you have the team making calls and you have the driver making calls. And I think Hamilton was respecting the team's call last time and went with that. And I think it was the wrong call.
Once he ignored, you know, Toto Wolff's got a competent crew. When they say box, box, box,
right,
I'd be in there. That's just me. But I'm not world champion. I don't know anything. So given that, he thought he could make it. He needed to stick with his decision.
I think so. I think that that makes more sense.
And if he had a tire going down, for instance,
that's different.
They'd know.
Yeah.
But they'd know in the pits.
That's right.
It's all monitored.
That's right.
Well, in the previous race too, though, they told him, we have more information. This is what it is. You know, come in. And so he respected that opinion and that decision, but they didn't say that this time.
And he wound up winning.
I heard him respond, why?
Why? Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, there you
now,
go.
Now, speaking of Lewis Hamilton, are you guys at all informed about the blonde girl?
Yeah, his personal trainer that carries his bag for him? Yeah.
Yeah. And boy, she does more than, Google her sometime.
Yeah.
This is a very interesting woman. Wowie. She not only trains his body, but his mind, his everything.
Total
his
trainer.
Whole attitude.
Holistic
she
trainer.
Is the whole
package. The full-on personal assistant.
Yeah.
Which I don't know of any other driver that has somebody like that.
No. And again, he's the world champion, so there's something to it.
Six or seven times in a row now, right? Seven times
in a row. Yeah, well, it doesn't get old.
Yeah. So they can fit her six-figure salary, which I'm sure is in the budget somewhere, right?
Yeah, they'll squeak it in somewhere. And I wish just once in a blue moon. Now, it was nice to see Mick Schumacher
qualify, get
make
past
a showing.
Yeah.
For a change.
That's right.
So that was encouraging to me. And I wish just once in a blue moon they'd mention Michael, but they stay, it's verboten.
Michael Schumacher?
Yeah, they
stay. Well, that's the family. That's the family. They put a lid on that.
It's not a pretty picture, but could you just once a year maybe say, you know, Michael's wife tells us, you know, thank you for all the good wishes, whatever.
There is things that come out in the media, Jim, and recently they...
Just not on the race tapes.
Correct. Yeah, recently there's been a documentary of sorts, family approved, that's come out about Michael that's going to be Netflix or HBO or something. Yeah,
good.
And it gets mixed reviews because it's family approved, right? So it doesn't show us anything we don't really know about Michael.
Right.
And again, everybody wants blood.
Yeah.
It's too bad.
So I'll tell you my Michael story real quick. The mother of my youngest daughter lives in France, and I was talking to her on the phone, and she was at the hospital visiting her niece. It was a brain trauma hospital in France. And as I'm talking on the phone, she says, hold on. Oh my God, they just wheeled in Michael Schumacher.
It's where he was skiing.
Yeah, she was standing there.
It's where he was skiing.
Yeah, she was standing there when they wheeled him in. So that was a moment in my history, you know.
Wow.
And yeah, they said that the injury came because he had a GoPro mounted on his helmet, and the mount for the GoPro compromised the integrity of the helmet, and that's what caused the injury.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
No, I never heard that.
Yeah.
What a waste. And you see people riding without helmets on motorcycles.
Crazy.
Just think, you know, you don't need a brain bucket unless you got a brain.
Yeah. So, and these are the guys that ride twice a year, too. You can tell by the way they're dressed and the way they ride. They have no business being on the road. And then they have a passenger in the back, right? The wife or girlfriend, no helmet, wearing shorts.
Oh,
these people.
Shorts, my favorite.
Yeah.
In the ER, we call them squids. When they come in on Friday night and they're all road rashed, head to foot.
Were you impressed with Tsunoda keeping Hamilton behind him for 10 laps in the beginning?
Yeah, there were a lot of good parts to that race.
Yeah.
And that was among them.
Yeah, that was good.
I did.
That was notable.
Yeah,
I noted it. So
it's not easy. And Hamilton's been known to lose his temper at times, but I think he knew he starting 10th with the engine change. I think he knew he was in trouble already.
And Tsunoda's probably tricky enough with the lines that he takes and his proclivity to leave the track on occasion that he's not the easiest guy to pass. I wouldn't imagine. You're not going to stick your nose in there.
True.
Knowing exactly what he's going to do. The other thing that I thought was notable was, and I'm going to note it again, Vettel and the tire change when he came in 2/3 of the way through the race and he went on to slick tires. Remember that?
Too soon. Yep, that was bad.
Another big mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was proven. He didn't even make it around the track, really, for that next lap with the slick tires on.
Yeah, I thought he was taking one for the team. He was taking one for all the teams.
That's right.
He did test the waters for everyone.
And he immediately said this experiment isn't working, horrible. I think was his exact message.
It's not working.
But they went to medium tires. Why, if you're going to go to slicks, why not go to the red tires? I mean, the track is damp. The tires aren't going to take that much wear. There was only 20 laps to go. I don't know. Seems like an odd. Yeah. So they had to bring him back in. And so he wound up finishing 16th or something. I think he probably deserved better than that. That
was hard to watch.
That Aston Martin seems so inconsistent to me. Some races it's fantastic and some races it's back of the pack.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder why. I don't know that it's the driver or the car.
I think it's the car. The car does some things exceptionally well and some other things it doesn't do well at all. And this is still the car that was the pink Force India, right? Which was the 2018 Mercedes, basically. They copied it panel for panel.
Boy, that's
and that was
car.
A good car, but maybe that car wouldn't be any good in 2021.
It was a good car in 2019.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah. The other thing, let's talk about, this is going to be interesting. To me, it's interesting. Track limits. Comes up every single race. There's a lot of controversy about it. You're giving me a quizzical look. So at some tracks, the track limits are a certain curb in certain corners, a certain outside of the curb in certain corners, or actually the white line that's inside the curb on certain corners. If you exceed the track limits, let's say you're trying to get on the main straightaway, it's turn 10, you come out, you cross the white line, your lap time is deleted during qualifying, so it doesn't count. And during the race, if you do that, you only get 2 or 3 warnings, and I think they give you, I don't know, some kind
like
of penalty.
A penalty.
Like 5 seconds.
Or
something like that, right? Yeah. What are your thoughts on track limits?
I miss the old days. You know, I can
Anything
remember
goes.
Using all the track and then some.
Yeah.
You know, when you're throwing too much grass off your tires, okay, you've gone too far.
Right.
And I think that's the biggest difference is that they redesigned the tracks to make it safer for drivers. So they put tarmac on the outside of these corners. So if they left the track, they could safely slow down, safely maneuver the car and get back on the track. The problem is, and I think it was Jensen Button that talked about this not last week, but previously, is that when a driver knows that there's not a waterfall there, that there's not a cliff.
They drive different.
They drive different. Yeah. Exactly. And
they drive through.
It's kind of like having training wheels, right? So why have track limits? Just let them drive.
I don't like them.
I like the first corner at the A ring, which is now called the Red Bull ring, I believe, in Austria.
Yeah, right? I bought it.
So it's an uphill right-hand corner, and on the outside of that corner, you have a big curb, and then laying on top of that curb is what they call sausage curbs, like big louvers that run the other direction. And on the other side of it is tarmac, right? So if you miss your breaking point or whatever, and you blow the corner entirely, you have a chance to go around the junk and get back on the track, but there's a time penalty to do that.
Right.
But it's a safe way to do it. However, if you just try to take the corner a little too fast, it rips parts of your car, it breaks wheels, it destroys tires. I like that. I like that there's a penalty for exceeding the track limit.
A physical penalty.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it will take the car apart.
Yeah, not just the steward deciding.
It could even splinter your wood plank.
Yeah, which is,
you never know.
Hate it when that happens.
We know that's not what's sparking.
Exactly.
No, but that makes sense though. It's a good strong deterrent. It doesn't really hurt anybody, but it takes you out.
Yeah.
Out of the race.
Any other thoughts on F1 this week overall? Jim, thanks for coming
in. Well, the only thing I have a question about is Susie Wolf. Does anybody follow Susie Wolf?
Susie Wolf is a very competent race car driver.
Yes.
She's the wife of Toto Wolf.
Yep.
She actually got hired, I think, as the third or fourth driver for Williams.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not anymore, but a few years ago. That's what I know about Susie Wolf. Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess it almost came to blows. One of them could stay in F1, and it was Toto. You know, I believe they have kids and they finally decided, well, remember the test driver, I think for Ferrari, who went into the back of a semi in a practice session? Not at a race weekend. This is about 5 or 6 years ago. And they had a woman test driver, and they never knew what happened. She just went off the track into a pit area and drove right into the back of a semi.
Wow. Wow. Almost like Bianchi
unfortunately,
in Japan. Yeah, that was a terrible accident.
Very, very similar result.
I vaguely remember that.
Because it was right at head level.
Well,
and thank God for the halos. That's a great improvement.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Not everybody can work with their wife like you can.
Oh, I can't. We fake it.
It's no, only
nobody.
For the public, right?
Yeah, trust me. My shrink tells me nobody can work with their wife.
Outstanding.
And I'm here to tell you.
Outstanding. Did you have another comment about Susie Wolf?
No, just that it would have been neat to see. I'm still waiting to see a woman make it.
Yeah.
I'm always for the underdog and breaking the glass ceiling. And boy, I'd love to see it happen. But that's a tough club to join.
Yeah, it's going to happen eventually. Well, thank you very much, Jim. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate you, Linda.
Absolutely.
Always a pleasure.
David, good
DJ.
To see you. You're listening to Cars and Crafts on 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM. Jim, thank you for coming. Reincarnation, we love having you here. Maybe next time.
We welcome and encourage your emails to cars.crafts013@gmail.com.
This program, Cars and Crafts, showcases local gearheads along with brewers and distillers. Join us on the air and online.
Cars and Crafts and KPPF remind you to drink responsibly.
All right, we're here at PPIR for the Rock and Rumble Show. So Matt and Katie in here. My name's David. Linda's here as well. You're the owners. Tell us about that.
We are the owners. We're the owners of Montrevino Urban Winery. It's a new wine concept that is planned to open in Colorado Springs here at Q1 2022 is our plan. But right now we're currently opened as Boxing Brothers Cider House. We're kind of expanding what we've done with the hard cider, and we are going into red wine and white wine.
Outstanding. And where are you based out of?
Here in Colorado Springs.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you buy from vineyards outside the area?
So we do. What's kind of great about an urban winery is we have the chance to buy from anybody. So as long as the product fits our profile, we're able to blend it. We're able to really find the best of the best, whether that's Colorado, California, Washington. You know, the world is ours.
That's outstanding.
Yeah.
So you have a background in blending and winemaking.
We do. And so we also helped start a distillery here in the spring. So really, craft spirits has been our focus
what
from
distillery?
Day one. Black Hat Distillery.
Okay. Oh, yeah, they do.
So Black Hat Distillery used to be Bluefish Distillery back in the day. And then we ended up purchasing them as they, you know, the original owners retired. And we bought them out and just want to continue on the legacy. So
outstanding. Katie, tell me about your background in winemaking and the distillery and all that.
You know, I don't really have a background in winemaking, to be honest. It's just sort of been an adventure learning more about Matt's passion. And so I'm just sort of here as a support. I am the professional drinker. I'll tell them what tastes good and what doesn't.
Yeah, she's kind of underselling it. Yeah, she is absolutely the palate.
Yeah, that's good.
She's also the accountant, so she lets me do the crazy stuff and approves everything.
So it's a team project.
It's a team project.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Is.
Yeah. For you guys.
Yeah.
So tell us about your background, Matt. Where did you come from?
So actually, Katie and I are high school sweethearts. We met in Florida, and then we went to college together. Right out of college, we tried to start an automotive engineering company. It was really hard to get money in the streets at that time. It was like 2010, so the housing market. We had a BP oil spill in Florida, so the people weren't investing in new startups at that time. But Colorado was kind of the land of opportunity. It was also a place that we had vacationed quite a bit, and we knew we could make really good wine, really good hard cider, so we decided to raise some money and come out to Colorado.
Give me for this question, Matt, but how do you go from automotive engineering to winemaking?
Yeah.
Did I miss something there?
No, you didn't, and I think there's actually a similarity there that a lot of people kind of look over. So it's really a perfect balance between science and art, and brewing's the same way. You're designing something, so you are a creator, but it also has to be functional and work, and there's science and art to both of those things.
Outstanding. What do you want, let's say we're reaching the vast majority of Colorado Springs population right now, what do you want people to know about your business and what you do and what you want to do for Colorado Springs, the stamp you want your brand to make?
Yeah, I think our stamp is really an innovation and progress. And so you see a lot of these things happen in bigger cities. You see these urban wineries in Portland and Seattle. You see them in Miami. And we're doing this in the Springs. And I think that's really important, is that the Springs has the culture that can represent that. And it's growing. And there's this new movement of young entrepreneurs there. And that's really important.
Well, it's very exciting.
Yeah, it's super exciting.
What did you intend to do? Since we're in the middle of all these cars, there's what? How many cars are out here, Chelsea? 400 cars?
No, we have 800 pre-registered, so I don't know the final count.
So maybe 1,000 cars.
Yeah, probably over 1,000.
Not including the other 2,000 cars of
in the field. Yeah. No.
Very impressive.
Well, what's so cool about Matt and Katie is they actually both drive in our track attack program here at DU. So it's so fun. They're already fans of the track, you know, and really they've been to Hot Rod Rock and Rumble before. So it's so cool that we get to help tell their story. And they're the official wine of NASA.
Yes, as we like to say, race NASA, not space NASA.
So NASA, for those of us that may not be that familiar.
It's the National Auto Sport Association. Uh-huh. And they're kind of the younger brother to the SCCA. Everybody knows SCCA. They've been around forever. NASA is 30 years old as well, so they've been around a long time. But they're kind of a newer take on what SCCA has done. So
what's very cool is they are going to be donating their white wine.
Our sparkling. As close to champagne as we can get. It's a California blend, of course, but it is sparkling like a champagne. It's made the old-fashioned way, too, so it's carbonated in the bottle, just like you'd have in France. And we're going to be donating it to the drivers who win the track attack this year. So,
and you can't call it champagne because
it doesn't come from the Champagne region of France.
That appellation system.
It is.
It's very impressive.
Yeah, it's just
very
kind impressive. Of like Kentucky bourbon. You know, you have some rules you have to play with it.
Right. So. Tell me about that blend.
Yeah, and so it's a California dry blend. It's a very intro level wine, under $20 a bottle. It's great for any meal. It's very approachable, but the story behind it is fantastic. And as hot rod people, as gearheads ourselves, we wanted to marry kind of those two back. You know, we had branched away from automotive engineering and we wanted to bring it kind of back to our wine lifestyle that we have. And so we named it after the Little Red Rooster, which is my favorite Rolling Stones song. But even that was named, we named the 29 Model A after that song. So it kind of just worked. And Little Red developed to be this mascot, which is this little hot rod. And so we named the wine after it. And it kind of travels around with us and helps us sell wine.
Can you tell us what grapes are in it? Or is that a...
No, we definitely can. So Petit Syrah.
Okay.
And then,
one
Pinot,
of my favorites.
Yeah,
delicious.
Yeah, Pinot Noir and Merlot.
Yeah,
so,
classic.
Yeah, just big, bold for a dry, but it actually finishes pretty easy.
Did you sneak anything in there that...
We did a little we did a little special. So we added it to Colorado whiskey barrels. And that gives it a little extra punch for a dry.
Okay. Yeah. All right. But those are the two primary grapes. Any other grapes in there?
Merlot, yeah. Two. Okay. So okay. Merlot was the other one.
All right. Well, sounds delicious. We'll have to try some.
Yeah. It is.
Visit Montservino Urban Winery at 4655 Town Center Drive, Suite 130 near Platt and Murray, and spend time,
like we did,
with Matt and Katie in their cozy tasting room sampling beautifully made wines.
And handcrafted Boxing Brothers hard cider.
Come find your favorite. Cars and Crafts and KPPF remind you to drink responsibly. Welcome back to Cars and Crafts on 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM. We're in the studios today, myself, David. Good morning.
Good morning, Linda.
David and Clint.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Perfect. We've got
a recording
great
in the morning. You can say good morning.
Well, it's all right.
Yeah.
It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday for everybody else.
For everybody else.
But. So what are we doing today? What are we talking about today? What's in the lineup today?
Our friend, yeah, Clint is back, gracious enough to join us. He bought a new car recently, which I'll let him talk about further. But as part of his process of doing that, did a lot of research on electric cars. And he's generally knowledgeable about the whole car industry because Clint actually works.
I am an auto broker, so I have to know a little bit about every brand, at least for passing conversation and to help people pair Bluetooth and whatnot, because we sell literally everything. Like you said, I try to be steeped in a little bit of the industry, you know, everywhere. I'm not an under the hood guy like you, but I'm a infotainment and, you know, this is how you put it in gear and on almost everything under the sun. So
you have a natural affinity for cars. It's kind of natural for you to collect information about cars. So don't sell yourself short. You are a
I did have a car poster or two on my wall. I believe it was an IROC Z was one of them.
Oh, very nice.
A little Americana there. But absolutely, I love cars. And the tough part about selling them is you get to see all the brand new gadgets and gizmos and bells and whistles on every car. And you go, ooh, my car doesn't have that. Ooh, my car doesn't have that.
Yeah, it's good thing your wife isn't exposed to that, right?
Getting
a new car every 6 months. You work for AAA up in the north end of Colorado Springs. It's a great gig being an independent car broker because you can represent every brand. Your dealership without inventory is perfect.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But the challenges for you lately have been
inventory. Chip shortage has absolutely pounded the industry. Combined with COVID plant shutdowns, it's been a 1-2 punch, and we're really pivoting towards helping people just order the car they want, because on hand is literally...
You don't get it.
Yeah. It's a fraction of what's normally available. Yeah. Normally, what we do through AAA is bring down the three cars you've narrowed it down to, and you could go 1, 2, 3, bang, bang, bang on your test drive.
Whether it's Mazda, Volvo, it doesn't matter.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. We're not limited to a brand because we work with all of them. So what's great about that is we can literally A, B, you know, Toyota and Subaru side mm-hmm. by side, and client gets to go drive literally completely different cars right. within seconds of each other, so they can actually remember, you know,
that's neat.
How, I like yeah, that. Yeah, how
and
this
you,
one drove.
And you do used cars, secondhand, pre-owned, whatever they call it these days, cars also.
Right.
You can do leasing. You also can arrange financing. Is that true?
Absolutely. Yep.
Nice.
Yep.
Nice. And one of the better things, I'm almost done plugging Clinton AAA, but one of the better things is the extended warranties that you offer. I think you've mm-hmm. got one of the best deals.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's up to 10 years or 125,000 miles on the odometer, and it works nationwide. But the advantage is if you go to a AAA approved shop, there's literally zero deductible.
Okay.
So yeah, it's
wow.
It's just super peace of mind. It's a great product.
And inexpensive,
yes.
relatively speaking.
Yeah. For a 10-year warranty. Compared to dealer options. And we need the dealers, obviously, to work with them. But yeah, we can just take such better care of people because we get them out of that high pressure environment.
So the chip shortage has affected new cars. Has it affected, it seems counterintuitive to ask this question, but has it affected electric vehicles as much as petrol or hybrids?
It's pretty even in its decimating of inventories, because even electric car still has similar chips for navigation, you know, backup camera, blind spot sensors. And the automotive chips are a little more simple. And not to go too far down the chip rabbit hole, but what happened was when COVID hit, everybody backed off their orders because they assumed demand was going to plummet.
Right.
And
the opposite happened.
Yeah. Exactly. Everybody had extra money because they weren't traveling. Demand skyrocketed, and all the chip foundries said, great, we've got extra capacity. And Apple and Dell Computers and Sony and Microsoft, they all bought that production time already. So the automakers went, no, just kidding. Please let us buy chips.
Right.
And the foundries said, we've got the next 2 years booked up solid, and automotive chips are much simpler, so they're not as high profit. So there was no incentive for them to not make chips for Samsung Galaxies and iPhones.
Current conversation from Tesla, among other things, is that he's talking about thinking about maybe actually building his own chip foundry. Do you know anything about this?
No, that's news to me. I just heard about the relocation to Austin.
Austin.
Yeah.
Yeah. How much did you read about that? Because that was an interesting story yesterday about the ramifications of that potentially in the Austin environment. Did you read that story or a similar story?
I read a much shallower dive, more talking about what it means for the California plant. You know, Muskie promised that he's still going to support the California operation. He actually intends to grow capacity there. But Austin, just Texas being more centrally located, you know, and it is an American car company that just helps with distribution by being in the center. And they're working on a big factory there for, I think they call it a gigafactory for the batteries. And then he can also be closer to SpaceX.
The story I read that did a little deeper dive was talking about they're going to put the headquarters out on the east end of Austin. And Austin is similar to Colorado Springs and Denver in their real estate market. Prices are ratcheting up. It's very difficult for first-time buyers to get involved. Linda knows more about that. She can talk about that. But the real estate people in Austin are very concerned about, you know, another, 5,000-10,000 people coming from California into the Austin environment.
Well, it's not just real estate. It's economics as a whole, because Denver, Colorado Springs, a lot of our community, our area models after the Austin, Texas, everything. You've got the walkable downtown, you've got the bike trails, you've got everything that's modeled from Austin is here. And that's what they're looking at. If you look at like the chambers and the EDCs, they do everything based off of Austin for some reason. I don't know if you know that.
No.
And then Texas as a whole, with some of my other background, energy is wide open. So there's no regulation of energy. It's deregulated in the entire state. So you've got SpaceX and you've got Elon Musk down there. Now you've got all kinds of options for Tesla and the electric vehicle market as a whole.
You've also got people who went without heat last winter and then got $5,000 monthly bills.
Yeah, I was going to say the $3,000 utility bill that became famous during the deep freeze.
Austin is unique in Texas, and I spent some time in Texas years ago, in that it is the capital of Texas. So the city government is there. And then also, there's the University of Texas that's been there. So Austin has always been the most stable economic environment in all of Texas. Over the years, there's been a lot of fluctuation in Texas, Dallas and Houston included, because of the oil business, because of the train business, and then, you know, agricultural and everything else. So Texas would fluctuate, especially real estate prices, where you'd see it quite a bit. Remember, famously, years ago, a guy that worked for me, good guy, he was a Houston guy. He bought a 4-bedroom, 2-story house on a lake in the Woodlands in North Houston, which is a beautiful area. On his credit card, you know, during a certain dip in the economy. But, you know, the conversation was that Austin never suffered from that. And that's maybe why Austin's such a model, because consistently for who knows how many years, a few decades now, Austin has been solidly growing, progressing, and doing a good job, like with you mentioned, with the public services and the music festivals and just their overall attitude about, you know, we're going to be different. Yeah. You know,
they're a great role model for the little cities like Colorado Springs.
Isn't that where South by Southwest is too?
I think
yes,
so, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I want to get back to electric vehicles. You had done some research about, and you sent it to me, which is why I know you did it. And I read it. It was very interesting. So I want you to talk more about it. The cost of driving a used car.
Oh, yes.
And then getting into a new electric vehicle. Does that make any sense for the planet and for you personally? And then the rest of it. Go on. I won't speak for you.
No. And I should have screenshotted some of the statistics because now I'm desperately trying to remember the numbers as well. But it was a YouTube video, a guy who's an engineer by trade, and he does these YouTube explainers, and he's super, super in the weeds, but he's great at it. And he tries to be as forthright with where he's getting his data and so on. And basically, the moral of the story is, you know, there's a what turns out to be a misconception that just driving your old car is better for the environment than going out and buying a brand new electric, because creating the brand new electric car is going to create emissions, you know, getting the materials, there's emissions, et cetera, et cetera. And so the misconception is that just hanging on to your old car is better. You know, it's actually greener. And he kind of debunks that pretty easily by taking in the carbon emissions of the existing vehicle. And he even does, I think, a 25 and 35 mile per gallon car. You know, so if you've got...
Right, I did see that, yeah.
Yeah, if you've got a Camry or an Impreza that's fantastic on gas, it still is very quickly offset by an all-electric vehicle. And he was saying the upside is by going electric, as the grid becomes more clean, you know, solar, wind, renewables, hydro, it's only going to become more green charging your car each night. Whereas in the beginning, you know, we still get a lot from coal,
right,
and natural gas and so on. But as those become more green, the car literally pays itself back in eco terms even more quickly.
So for you personally, you analyzed all this, you look at it, you're a low carbon footprint guy, just the way you live and just your attitude. You're really a holistic man of the universe. Yet the decision you came up with.
Yeah. So I, as I've mentioned on one of our previous shows, I actually ordered a new WRX because the new one was so goofy looking. And
you ordered a 21 because you didn't like the 22.
Correct. Wow. Correct. Okay. Yeah. Cool. So I locked in the sort of existing design footprint.
Nice.
And not to go off on that tangent, as is my way. But
that's why you're here, Clay.
So yeah. And then I was, you know, I kind of had a revelation in the morning. I woke up and said, what am I doing? You know, this is my opportunity. I've got a clean title trade. I've got some, you know, I've got a lot of equity. Like maybe it's time for me to pull the trigger and go full electric. And so I spent the morning, and Tesla is very, you know, modern. You know, you jump on the website and it's, you know, configure your car. It's all a very nice online experience. You can literally order the car and never talk to a salesperson.
Well, for years they didn't have any dealerships, so that was the only way you could get a car. So they had to be good at the website part of it.
Yep.
Lately they've opened dealerships. I know there's one here in town. I don't know if that's widespread or not, but
I think that's a service center first.
I think it's just a service center.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
But they do have one in the Park Meadows. They actually had like a retail bay in the...
It was in the mall, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Next to the Gap. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. So carry on with your process.
Yeah. So I jumped on the configurator. And as you know, I'm a mountain enthusiast, you know, either just going for a spirited drive, but more importantly, I moved to Colorado for snowboarding. And so I jumped on the configurator and I was like, okay, I need the bigger battery pack, you know, because I need to make it to Breck and back or Monarch or what have you. And you can't assume that you're going to have a charger charger open,
right.
You know, and there's, frankly, there's not that many chargers yet. So I plugged in the bigger battery and the all-wheel drive system, and I literally was already at 50 grand.
Jeez.
Yeah. And I couldn't do it. Tesla is a very nice car. It performs well because of the low center of gravity and the instant torque, but it was 20 grand more than the Rex. That's more fun to drive because it's got three pedals. And I've had conversations where, because they don't have the federal tax rebate anymore because they've sold so many electric cars, they're now paying the price for pushing electric forward. You know, you can buy a plug-in Jeep 4xe and get the 7,500, and I want to say it's up to like six for the state credit. You know, so you can get like 13 grand back for buying a plug-in Jeep, which still only gets 20 miles of electric range. And Tesla, you know, pioneered all of this. Right. They did all the heavy lifting, and you have to pay full pop, as they say.
And they keep pushing up their prices, but they have to find a way to make money, even though their stock price has been jumping through the roof. They've had a problem being profitable, I think, until recently.
Yeah, but you'll always have followers following followers, right? So Apple follows Apple. Try to get somebody to switch from an iPhone to an Android. They won't do it. Try to get somebody to switch from a Tesla to something else. They're not going to do it.
Right.
It's going to take a whole lot of something for them to switch. So even though they might be paying the price now for what they did before, they've got a huge loyal base. Yeah. They're not going anywhere.
They are, like you said, they have actually started turning a profit. And I want to say it's the last two or three quarters.
Yeah.
They're kind of on a roll.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the design is always subjective. I know you wouldn't be caught dead, you know, and disintegrated inside one.
Well, the Model S, I think, is gorgeous. The rest of them.
Yeah, sorry. Fair. Yeah. And you're right. The S is gorgeous. The 3 tried to maintain the smaller, the airy cabin, but it's on a smaller chassis. So it just ends up looking a little Jetsons.
The front end's totally horrible, too. Totally. It's awful.
Yeah. But yeah, that was the idea. I was like, okay, let's do it. Let's go green. And it's just too cost prohibitive right now. And
for you personally, in your household.
Yeah, right.
To your credit, you've had a Leaf previously. You talked about in the last show. And I know you had a WRX previously. So these are all things you're familiar with. And you were looking forward to getting back to the three pedals.
Yes.
That was a primary motivator for you. And the electric car doesn't have that. Now, Linda, you had talked about also, you've had a couple. You have a Tesla now. You're in your family. And
I had an i3.
You had an i3. Mm-hmm. And you talked about how much you didn't like driving them in the snow because of the instant torque.
Right. I didn't learn how to drive in the snow with an electric vehicle. Nobody taught me how to do it. I didn't want to learn how to do it because it was a leased car. And I didn't want to ruin the wheels, scrape anything up. I didn't want to ruin it. So it was very difficult for me to drive in the snow or anything, even wet, in that little i3. So I'm a fair weather driver when it comes to electric vehicles. And then when you immediately pull off the accelerator, it starts to instantly brake, instant braking. So I couldn't even control from that point. So I was driving with 2 feet, braking with one and keeping the accelerator on. So I don't know. It was difficult for me to figure out how to drive.
It sounds awkward. It's something you wouldn't normally think of, but that instant torque is a problem in the snow. I know.
Especially in Colorado.
Yeah, you're much better off to start. If you got a manual, start off in second or third, turn the tires over really slowly. But you don't have those options in the electric vehicle, as far as I know. You said there used to be a snow button.
There was a snow option, right? A winter option in the Tesla. Got caught last year out in the boonies, driving the car back. And the entire time from Peyton to my house, which is near like Penrose Hospital area, I was searching for the winter mode, trying to install it on the car. By the time we got home, we were already home. Uh-huh. And we found out that they no longer have that option.
Did you drive a four-wheel drive Tesla in the snow? Have you ever done that?
No, I've my friend is the typical Californian, lives in San Diego, has a Model 3, you know, but it was rear-wheel drive. So yeah, I have not experienced one in the snow. And that is a good point. And that brings up another interesting thing for people who are a little more old school is over-the-air updates. You know, I'm sure that would terrify some consumers that, right. Hey, your car doesn't have this anymore because we patched it overnight through the cell phone and you didn't know until it was snowing.
There's quite a few cars that do that, though, those over-the-air updates. That's become more common, I think, in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
They're constantly updating your car. But it's terrible when they take something away that you're expecting to be there.
Right.
Especially when you need it.
Right.
Like you're out in the boonies, you know that you have it, and then you find out that you don't. It's just, yeah.
So you actually got your hands on an electric car for one of the first times, right?
Well, it is the first time I actually drove one. Linda and I, which I mentioned before, we drove the Mustang Mach-E, and we were not impressed. Now, you've educated me since then that there's different levels to that, which I wasn't entirely aware of. And we probably drove the two-wheel all-wheel drive,
probably
lower
the base
battery
model,
pack
yeah.
version, right? It was a beautiful car. You couldn't tell from being inside. I couldn't. But there was other models there, and they threw us the keys to one, and we drove it. We didn't ask any questions.
Yep.
So what I read also this morning that the Mach-E GT is out. They actually call it a Mach-E Mustang GT. Mm. So in the higher levels of the Mach-E, you could get a bigger battery pack, which gives you more power, and a larger motor, and then also another smaller motor for the four-wheel drive system. So we probably drove not that, right? So the Mach-E GT gets the bigger motor on both ends and the bigger battery pack, and it's actually supposed to run
more
and drive.
Power, more torque.
Whatever. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's how they kind of the industry is already going, and Tesla did lay the foundation for that, like we've talked about, where they have kind of laid the foundation for so many things. So Mercedes, they just got their EPA rating on the new EQS, which is fully electric, but it's an E-Class sedan, but looks nothing like a typical E-Class or S-Class. I think it's actually supposed to compare to the S-Class, excuse me, but their naming leaves a little bit to be desired.
It has for years, really. But a lot of car manufacturers suffer from that, but go on.
But yeah, so it came... So like I said, Tesla has kind of laid that foundation where it's like you get one motor in the back wheels. And then if you want the more performant version, it actually automatically becomes all-wheel drive. You get a front and rear motor and sometimes a bigger battery pack. Sometimes they just basically open up the fake gearing. So the Mercedes jumps from, I want to say it's like 300 up to 600 equivalent horsepower. The Taycan is similar. The Ford is similar where you add, like you said, that second motor. And so you're literally, in some cases, doubling your horsepower and torque.
Right.
They have the technology to put a different motor at every wheel of the car, which gives you four-wheel steering and some other goofy stuff. Does the Cybertruck do that? Does the Rivian do that? Do you know? I read somewhere one of them did, I think.
I believe the Rivian is four independent, I believe. But again, it's funny. We went from one on the market to now there's very quickly becoming a glut because you've got the Rivian that I think the first couple just rolled off the production line. They just celebrated that. And that's a beautiful truck.
It's very good looking.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
I would say it's like retro futurism.
Nice.
Cool. Yeah, it
could be in a Star Wars movie, right?
Yeah.
No.
It's got there's two to three people in this room who, you know, have very specific opinions on Star Wars. But it's very modern. It's very clean. It doesn't have the, you know, opposite end, the Ferrari, Lamborghini strakes and vents. And it's very clean, but it's...
Our good friend Josh made that comment. I showed him a picture of, I forget what it was, but it was a cool little electric. It looked like a Lotus Elan hardtop, right? Really that retro styling, but a very clean design, like the first Mazda, you know, where it's just basically a shape, my first MX-5 I'm talking about.
Yep.
And he made the comment that because they don't have to move air through the car, so much that the designers can get a lot cleaner without all the strakes, without all the scoops, without all the this and the that, because this is a beautiful little car. I thought it was a very insightful comment. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, it does. Oh, well, and Tesla and
the Taycan has that look.
Yeah.
Just very clean. No junk.
It's a little, it still pays more homage to the rest of the lineup, I think, than it even needs to. You should check out the Mercedes because it is a little bit more of that. What they call it in software devs, and I'm sure visual design, but they call it clean sheet design. And like you said, you're not beholden to anything. So it opens things up. It almost looks like the Rivian, you know, part of the reason I love it is it looks like you're almost buying the concept car that's usually too forward thinking, too cool looking on the show floor.
Like the Cybertruck, maybe, although I'm not sure that the world will ever catch up with that doorstop design. I'm just
surprised.
Not a fan. Are you a fan of the Cybertruck, Linda?
No, I know people that are.
Yeah. Well, I know people that are too. I you know, I who knows how much is true, but at least 100 people have told me they put deposits down on one. You know.
Wow. Yeah.
Easily.
And that was a combination of Tesla's know-how, and he just kind of went out of the blue, said, hey, it's a truck. Why not make it out of stainless steel? You know, why? It's a truck. It's going to get banged up. Like, embrace it, you know?
Right. Who cares?
Yeah. Kind of the anti-truck.
Yeah.
So that brings us up to date to a certain point. Linda?
I'm good. Are you good, Clint?
Yeah. And next time we can talk about just some of the other guys playing on the market, like you mentioned.
The Lucid Air. The Lucid Air is gorgeous.
All right.
Thanks
so
for coming in, Clint.
It's a good
My
wrap.
Pleasure.
Thanks for joining us, David, Clint.
Linda.
Good to see you. Join us next time.
A few more things I wanted to talk about. Maybe next time.
Maybe next time.
Yeah, maybe next time. We'll have Clint back again. Thank you, Clint.
For sure.
Thanks, Linda.
Guys. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Cars and Crafts on 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM. Had a great time with you guys today. Looking forward to the next show. What are we going to talk about next time, David?
We'll be out at car shows and your favorite local brewery, meeting and talking with personalities and entrepreneurs building cars
and filling kegs
every week here on Cars and Crafts.
Stay tuned. See you next time on Cars and Crafts, 98.5 FM, 1040 AM, and 95.7 FM.
The power
of people.